contend that the proper resolution of this case is to find that the court erred by dismissing Mr. Harris's post-conviction motion, particularly with regard to the grounds of prosecutorial misconduct relating to not turning over information about Mr. Allgood's interview back at the time of the second trial.
Before we get to that, is this really a third amended post-conviction motion?
Yes.
Okay. Was it filed?
There was a motion to amend that was, granted. There was not...
Is there a doc entry that says it was granted or a journal entry?
Yes, there is a journal entry. Okay. And that should be in the record with regard to the... this is a very complicated procedural posture. And I took over the case. I obviously didn't do the initial filing. So I took it over shortly after Mr. Susi left. In handling the evidentiary hearing, we discovered that the third amended post-conviction motion, there had been a motion for leave to file with the motion attached that had been filed and approved. The third amended post-conviction motion was not subsequently again filed, or at least if it was, there is no record in justice or record. Also, there was a problem with the exhibits, there are numerous exhibits that were described in the original motion and the motion for leave to amend as being attached. When we went to district court, they weren't attached, so we offered those all in the evidentiary hearing and made a record that we were clearly talking about this. All parties proceeded as though that was the understanding and that it had been filed.
Is the third amended motion offered or marked as an exhibit at that post-conviction hearing?
I believe so. I believe that there's numerous copies of it in the record. It just hadn't been officially refiled after leave to amend had been granted.
It's never been filed in. There's no file stamp.
That's my
okay. What's your theory of the case here that somehow Harris, there were two witnesses out there that would have testified that Homicide Hicks was really the perpetrator of this crime and that Harris has been wrongfully convicted and that counsel has been ineffective for failing to call these two witnesses?
Essentially, I mean, those witnesses are, that is the cumulative evidence in the record at this point. Things are further complicated because Mr. McFlynn's information came forward well after the trial was had, and obviously the state didn't have that information to turn over. I submit to you that the way that the case should be resolved is to find, like I said, the prosecutorial misconduct in not disclosing that Mr. Allgood was at least interviewed, and I think that the issue there is...
Does the state know that he was interviewed?
They do now. I mean, it was very clear in the evidence, well...
After the filing of the third amended post-conviction, or at least the second.
Law enforcement interviewed him. There's no, as far as I can tell, there's no dispute in the record that law enforcement interviewed him. I think that if you consider the evidence as a whole, there's circumstantial evidence to support that there was a report probably generated from that interview, and that probably was turned over in some way to Ms. Wettelsdorf, because I don't know why you would subpoena someone and ask them to testify and endorse them as a witness if you had no idea what their relevance was to the case.
Is that speculation?
I don't think it's speculation as much as it's circumstantial evidence. When you look at the circumstances as a whole, it is clear that she had a policy of endorsing people only, I mean, either they were included in the police report somewhere, he is nowhere in any of the police reports, so that explanation doesn't apply. And he was endorsed only for the second trial, not for the first trial. So some kind of information had to have come in between the first trial and the second trial that said this guy has information that we want to bring out at trial. She ultimately decided not to call him, but she did move to endorse him.
On the second trial?
The second day of the second trial.
And then, help me out, I'm sorry, on the affidavit? Forgive me, I'm trying to keep up with you. The date of the affidavit?
I don't recall offhand
okay.
the date of the
I'm
affidavit.
Just trying
it certainly
to
was well
put after. A chronology together. Okay, thank you.
Both Mr. Allgood and Mr. McClinton were discovered well after even the first post-conviction motion was litigated, which is part of what complicates this.
Thank you.
It's also complicated because Mr. McClinton and Mr. Allgood were discovered after the time had run for motion for new trial to be filed and received upon. What is important about Mr. Allgood, though, is that he was endorsed at the same time as Mr. Agnew, who was a lieutenant, I believe. Reports were provided to the defense about Mr. Agnew along with the motion to endorse, but not regarding Mr. Allgood. Part of the circumstantial evidence that suggests to me that there is, in fact, some report out there regarding Mr. Allgood is that OPD sent over a significant number of reports, I think it was 29, to Ms. Wettelsdorf in the morning that she endorsed this gentleman.
What would Mr. All, what would Mr. Allgood have said? What do you claim he would have said?
I think what you consider for the purposes of materiality is all of the information that he would provide now. I think what is important
would he have misstated Hicks' deal?
Well, that's a separate issue. Do you mind if I finish this?
I beg your pardon.
But what is important about Mr. Allgood is that there is no dispute in the record that he was interviewed by police, that police took notes, and that they came and asked him a very specific question. Did you see Hicks, Harris, and Corey Bass together the night of the murder? And he said, no, I only saw Bass and Hicks together. That is important in and of itself, and I think material and exculpatory evidence, because had that information been disclosed to trial counsel testified at the post-conviction hearing that he would have explored that, because it was some kind of evidence that impeached what Harris was saying about being, or not Hicks, Harris, impeached what Hicks was saying about being with Harris all night, and it also put him in another location by himself with somebody else, Corey Bass, whose relevance wasn't really known at the time. So it provided all this information that he would have looked into had he known that.
And that occurred at 10:30 at night, is that correct?
I think that his best guess was around that time.
Do we know what time the murder occurred?
I don't recall the specific time. I think it was probably closer to evening hours, but I don't know for sure.
Is that in the record?
I'm sure that it is. I apologize. I don't recall right offhand what the evidence was. I think it was somewhat in dispute. Mr. Harris had a pretty elaborate alibi explanation that he had been seen driving on another side of town, or his car, which is a fairly...
El Camino?
Yeah, very distinctive El Camino was seen driving in one part of town around the time of the murder.
Well, is that at 3:30 in the morning he's seen?
Well, I think it was seen twice. I think it was seen earlier on in the night, and then also later on, he was actually pulled over. And so that was part of the question of, you know, is there, was there time for him to be seen driving and to go commit the murder in this very elaborate way that Hicks explained and then be pulled over later? So there are, I think the timing is enough of a question that Hicks, or that Allgood and the Clinton's information is helpful. And to go back to the sentencing issue, the sentencing issue is problematic because there are a number of things in the record that indicate misrepresentations. And they're very clear and obvious misrepresentations that cannot be disputed. I think the most prominent one is that she allowed Mr. Hicks to testify that this other case, the Paler shooting, was dismissed for lack of identification, when Paler had actually testified earlier that he knew Hicks because, yeah, that's the dude that shot me. So, I mean, obviously there wasn't a misidentification there. It's pretty clear that he knew exactly who had shot him because he testified as such. That was stricken from the record, but I think it still goes to that point that it's a misrepresentation that she knew.
Does the post-conviction judge deal with this plea agreement misstatement?
No. The judge completely omitted it from any analysis, which is part of the allegation that I made that the court erred by not addressing that point.
So how will we treat that?
I think that it's just a failure to rule on that. I mean, I think saying nothing is the same as overruling it, because obviously we didn't grant relief with regard to that point. I think the court could obviously remand it for further consideration of those issues.
Well, if it's a overruling by admission, then we don't remand it for reconsideration. We would decide that was an error.
I would think that probably the most appropriate response would be to say, we'll remand it back to the district court for findings on that point. I bring up the point of it being overruled by lack of addressing it because of the state's argument that I waived it by not filing a motion to alter amend. I won't belabor that.
Let me ask you just specifically to state, what relief are you seeking here in this action?
I'm asking the court to remand, to overrule the state's, or the district court's ruling that Mr. Harris's post-conviction motion is not merit relief on the ground of not disclosing exculpatory evidence with regard to Mr. Allgood's interview and that particular exculpatory evidence. I think that you look at the rest of the evidence in total to determine materiality under Bagley, and I think then you can basically grant him post-conviction.
What kind of post-conviction?
I think you find that there was a Sixth Amendment violation of prosecutorial misconduct for not turning over that evidence. I think there's also a separation under Kyles v. Whitley, because Relsdorf specifically testified that she had a policy of telling basically advocating her duty of disclosure to law enforcement, saying, don't tell me stuff you don't want me to tell the defense. So if there are things that you don't want me to tell them,
you're asking for a new trial?
I'm sorry.
You're asking for a new trial?
Yes, I'm asking for a new trial.
Okay.
How does McClinton's affidavit fit into this?
Well, McClinton's affidavit, if I may, I apologize in close time.
Yes.
Okay. McClinton's affidavit fits in because although there's the complication of a new trial, you know, we were properly raised under a motion for new trial, timely filed. However, that evidence came in late, so this court's already overruled the motion for new trial. McClinton's affidavit comes into play because it corroborates what Aldrin's saying. It corroborates a lot of evidence that is presented in the actual trial, and it shows, when you look at the record as a whole, under all the totality of the circumstances, as Bagley tells us we're supposed to, you see that this is a case that merits relief, because under Bagley, we're supposed to look at whether a fair trial is received and a verdict worthy of confidence has occurred in the context of the entire record. So you look at McClinton, and you look at Allgood, and you look at the sentencing issue. You even look at the fact that the Cass report wasn't turned over in the first post-conviction motion.
Why don't we rule on that Cass issue already?
Yeah, that's done. But I think you still look at it within the totality of the circumstances. Because, I mean, the way I read Bagley is you're saying you look at all of it. You look to see if all of these things hadn't gone wrong, would you still have confidence in this verdict? And I submit to you that you cannot have confidence in this verdict if you acknowledge that all these things are problematic. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state in this matter. As with respect to Curtis Allgood, Allgood was interviewed at some point in time long after the murder, even he says the earliest it would have been was about a year. That's what he said in his affidavit. In his testimony, he said he started waffling even more than that. It might have been 2 years afterwards, so we don't even really know how much or how long after the murder he was interviewed. And the only thing he did was he answered the very specific questions posed to him by the police officer. The officer asked him, did you see Hicks and Harris and Bass together? First, I think he said at any time, and he said no. Then he said, well, I saw Hicks and Bass probably around the time that Boo was killed. That's the sum total of his testimony. Now, in his affidavit, he goes on and gives considerably more detail and says that Hicks came rushing into the house, basically bursting into his house while Corey Bass was there, and was very agitated and flustered and told Bass something to the effect that it's been handled. Well, now, if you go back and look at what homicide
was hit. There mud tracked into his house?
Yeah, he was apparently upset that he was going to catch heck from his wife because the house was getting dirty, so he basically...
Who tracked in the mud?
Hicks. Yeah, that's my understanding. And if you go back and look at Hicks's original statement to the police, Hicks was originally arrested in the Jones homicide, and he said, Harris and I went to Jones's apartment to rob him. He had drugs and money, we were going to rob him. While we were there, apparently, in the course of the robbery, Jones recognized Harris, and that's why Harris shot him. Now,
did Hicks say was present at the time of the robbery?
At the robbery, my recollection is that it was him and Harris and Boo Jones. And Harris shot him, and they, after...
So it was just Hicks and Harris that were doing the robbery?
That's my recollection.
Okay.
If you look at Olga's later statement, the affidavit and his testimony, Hicks's statement actually starts to make considerably more sense. Homicide Hicks earned his nickname, apparently. He was Corey Bass's hitman. McClinton was his leg breaker. Homicide was the hitman. He kills people for a living. He would have no reason to be flustered and agitated and upset if he had been the person to shoot Boo Jones.
The state gave him a deal, though, didn't it? That didn't charge him with the homicide in this case.
That's correct.
Even though he was there. Even though they knew that he kills people for a living.
Sometimes you have to make deals with the devil, and that's unfortunate. It's unfortunate, but that's kind of the way this has to work sometimes. But even though they made the deal with him, because his original statement to the police was, I didn't kill him, Harris did. I was there, I saw what happened, but I wasn't the actual shooter. I can tell you what happened. And when you look at Olga's ultimate statement, Harris's statement makes sense because, excuse me, Hicks's statement, I'm getting these guys mixed up. Hicks's statement makes sense because he wouldn't have any reason to be perturbed by shooting another person. It was another death, another dollar to him. If you're at a robbery that you had anticipated only being a robbery and things went south and devolved into a homicide, well, that may be some cause for you to be upset about that and get, you know, excited about it. But if you look at the two of them as they flow together like this, it starts to make a certain amount of sense. And therefore, Olga's statement isn't, Olga's statement to the police is not Brady material. It's just because what he told the police at the time of his interview was that, no, I didn't see them together. I saw Hicks and I saw Bass together. I was working
on
Bass.
What was Bass's involvement in this, if any? Why was he with Hicks at Allgood's place?
The only reason they came together on the night of the homicide was Bass's was at Allgood's place because Allgood was working on Bass's car.
Okay.
And Hicks came running in and off we go.
How do we reconcile? Let me try it in a different way. Hicks was endorsed at the second trial. What's the? Is that right?
Hicks was?
Allgood.
Allgood?
I beg your pardon.
That's okay. I'm getting them all confused.
Okay. Yeah. Allgood was endorsed at the second trial?
Yeah, he was a late endorsement.
Okay. What is the significance of that? I'm sorry. Yes.
Nobody knows. He and Agnew were endorsed at the same time. Neither witness was called. And Rettelsdorf was asked about it. And, you know, a decade and a half after she didn't call them as witnesses, she has no idea why anymore that they were not called as witnesses. And, you know, as you logically would not, you don't call them as a witness. You just kind of wipe them off your scoreboard and go on with what you consider to be your important witnesses. So that, you know, this happened so long after the trial, there's no way for anybody to go back and recreate why you didn't call someone as a witness. The only evidence we do know is that at the time of the second trial, the only evidence we had from Allgood was his statement that I didn't see Hicks, Harris, and Bass all together. I saw Hicks and Bass together around the time that the Jones murder occurred. That, you know, adds basically nothing to the equation for anyone one way or another. If you had Allgood come forward with the rest of his information, and he said, he was, you know, pretty honest about it. He said, no, I didn't tell them anything else. I didn't want any problems. The police had been basically kind of picking on him because he associated with gang members because he worked on their cars, and so they considered him a gang member, and he was just trying to get the police out of his hair and out of his life. So he said, I didn't tell them anything more than that. I didn't volunteer anything.
Do you consent that we're on this third amended post-conviction motion? Is that how the state proceeded at the hearing?
I think that's right, yeah.
They really didn't object to the evidence that dealt with the added allegation of the plea agreement misstatement. Is that correct?
That's my recollection of the record, yeah.
So somewhat by non-objection or implicitly, we agree that we're all on the third amended post-conviction motion.
I think
motion.
So.
All right.
I think that's where we're at.
So if we're on the third amended post-conviction motion, then the post-conviction judge does not address the third allegation of that third amended post-conviction motion, i.e. the plea agreement statements. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What's the effect of that? How do we handle that?
I don't think you need to. There is no ruling for this court to decide whether it was right or wrong. The fact of the matter is, because that wasn't addressed at the lower court level, it is incumbent on the person presenting those issues to get a ruling on those issues. And if you don't, either file a motion for reconsideration or some motion to alter or amend the final order, then you essentially default the issue when it comes up on appeal. And there's nothing for this court to resolve one way or another. It's not an implicit denial. You know, if you've got something denied, there has to be a reason for it.
So it's not denial by omission.
I don't know that we have ever recognized an denial by omission. That's going to be very strange. I don't know how you would deal with that.
And we have no findings on it. We have no rulings.
Exactly. There would be, you know, one way or another, there's nothing to deal with. There is nothing for you to say is right, wrong, or indifferent.
And the judge refers back to the second amended post-conviction motion in his order, doesn't he?
He does, yeah.
Think that's by error?
Yeah, this has been through so many iterations that it's hard for anybody to keep this straight at this point of the game.
We all agree, even think the judge is on the third amended post-conviction.
I think so.
But just inadvertently did not address that third allegation.
I think he was probably looking back at prior pleadings and whatnot and just broke second winning that third.
Is it possible to say no ruling is tantamount to a denial?
I don't know how. No, I don't think you can. It's just, no ruling is no ruling. It's just no ruling. There's because if it's a denial, there has to be some reason for it. There has to
well,
be.
Well, would we if there's no ruling, would we have to send it back to the court with directions to consider that last part of the post-conviction motion that it didn't address?
No, I don't think so. Because when the order came out, it was clear from the in the district court's order that there was no ruling. And I think at that point in time, because there was no ruling, if you wanted a ruling on it, you could address that omission to the court, and that was not done. So it's simply not before this court properly at this time. See, I'm almost out of time. If there are further questions, we would ask that the...
How does McClinton's affidavit fit into this? We haven't talked about him yet.
I don't really think it does, because even McClinton is said, I didn't tell anybody anything until 2006 or 2007 when he got a hold of Jerry Susie, because he learned he was Jack Harris's counsel, and he said, well, I thought maybe I could help myself because I wanted help with my case, so I got a hold of Susie and said, hey, I've got some information for you. The state can't turn over what it doesn't know exists. There was nothing for it to possess or to turn over at the time of trial. So McClinton wasn't on anybody's radar at the time of trial and only came about years afterwards when he made himself known to the parties.
So he's really irrelevant because of the passage of time.
I think so. I think so, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any rebuttal time? Thank you. That concludes the arguments for this week, and we are adjourned. Parties are excused.